High FM 101.9 megahertz of life.
Good morning, everybody, and welcome to Sorrow Gone Rogue, talking about everything politics, and politics is everything in our lives. Unfortunately, this is a truth, and I am back in Joburg where the weather is balmy, unlike Cape Town, which was actually lovely while I was there for the couple of days, but by all accounts, it is raining, and they are having car accidents in the traffic, plus the pressure of traffic to go with it. So careful what you wish for, I guess. I'd like to start with a somewhat tragic story that probably hasn't garnered much attention, and that is that there are three completely 100% state-owned bus companies in the Northwest. So the Northwest provincial government owns them entirely. And they were placed under business rescue in 2022 amid evidence of mismanagement and possibly criminal and financial irregularities. The problem is that there's been a dispute regarding the business rescue practitioner, and he was the first one was removed from the matter by the court, and he is going on appeal. But what this resulted is that his replacement has had to deal with the fact that these court actions, amongst other activities, have not only caused the debt to increase dramatically, but in that, since 3 years since this process went underway, 1,500 employees have received their salaries very erratically. And in some cases, it's been, I think in 2023, they received 3 months of salary in virtually a year of working. And what is particularly tragic about this ongoing battle and this fight to see who has the legal right to be the business practitioner, the business rescue practitioner, at least 14 of those 1,500 employees have taken their own lives, and one has actually starved to death. And by all accounts, the situation for the families is absolutely dire. Their homes have been repossessed, cars have been repossessed, and many of those people will have had considerable years of service. And all this while, this carries on. And one of the problems, apparently, with the original business rescue practitioner is he was not paying over salaries to staff during this period. And that was fundamental to his replacement by someone who seems committed to it, but who may, in essence, not have the law on his side. So to be in a position where people are literally saying that they're not even struggling anymore, they are completely broken, they've lost all hope they can ever have, and it's dignity, literally sanity and lives are at stake, and it's just a reminder of how far-reaching the consequences of government action, inaction, and malicious action can take us.
High FM, your station of choice since 2008.
Well, the very vexed question of BEE and whether we should finally do away with it, because it's in fact having overall relatively no benefit to the vast majority of people in South Africa, who theoretically it is intended for, and has benefited virtually the same small group of people who keep coming into and out of the system as tenders pop up, companies get created, and suddenly they're tenderpreneurs who benefit hugely and often with no results to show for it whatsoever. So we all know that the extent to which the bureaucracy involved in BEE, as compared to the benefit it actually gives the wider society, is a disincentive to business, both local and foreign. And there's been quite a bit of pushback on this. I mean, when you have a magazine, a media house like The Economist, which has always had, I thought, somewhat more perhaps giving a response to much of the ANC's activities. It actually came down in an article about a week ago, very, very hard against the perpetuation of BEE, to the point where it actually said, one comment was about the fact that Mr. Ramaphosa, what made you rich is making the people of South Africa poor. And it quoted a lot of the information and the research that's going on around at the moment, including Professor William Gumede Witz's research, which reveals about R1 trillion has literally been to the benefit of about 100 people. That's what BEE has done for us. Now, in consequence of all this, what the ANC has done is now essentially doubled down on BEE and called for beneficiaries to defend it. Now, you know, I assume what they're trying to say is that those businesses that have benefited from having ownership in companies by virtue of BEE charters and laws, and anyone who may have benefited from some or other program, I'm sure they do not mean the tenderpreneurs, because the story is so bad and the corruption has, I don't even need to go into the various myriad of corruption and tender rigging that goes on. There's almost a new story every day. But for the ANC to actually say that the beneficiaries must come out and defend it means, by implication, that there are not enough people who are beneficiaries of it, and those who are must come out and say something about how wonderful it is. And that is really, really problematic. I mean, honestly, is the ANC that devoid of value, of actually expressing any real value in it? They said in the call for people to defend BEE that research needs to be done to see whether BEE has been doing what it is supposed to, with, quote, actionable insights to carry the policies forward. Now, the question one has to ask is, why does the ANC not have this information at its fingertips if it is so valuable and is so worthy of support and ongoing application? What it's done is simply reiterated that in terms of our democratic framework, it is designed to benefit black South Africans, that is, Africans, coloured and Indians, and further extends benefit to white women who were historically marginalised. Now, let's be honest, I think white women stopped benefiting to the extent that they ever benefited a long time ago. But it's also the nature of the charters that are being drafted by various government departments is such that in applying these really bizarrely calculated mathematical criteria as to what percentage of a company should be owned by the color of, depending on what the color of the person is, you end up with like 0.4% white men should be holding certain positions. You also have a bizarre situation where black women couldn't get ahead because positions, according to these charters and these bizarre calculations, are already overrepresented in certain areas. It is the cost and the slowdown in for anyone wanting to do anything for the South African economy is just, in and for the South African economy, is just dreadful. But there's really light on the horizon. SACA-Lega, the business forum, won about a week ago a case in the High Court against the Air Services Licensing Council. Now, what the Licensing Council does is it basically gives licenses to operate to all kinds of air services, and it's not just passenger services. It can be vehicle trackers, wildlife trackers, firefighters. From, you know, anything that operates from the air ambulances, is an air it requires a license from the Air Services Licensing Council. Then suddenly about towards the end of during 2023, perhaps possibly a little earlier, it suddenly started to put in BEE requirements. It didn't even have a legislative framework, and I think right now one could argue against any legislative framework anyway in terms of not being constitutional. It goes way beyond the permissive mandate of dealing with previous disadvantage. But they had just imposed these requirements, and a number of air services company approached Sakalecha because it has a reputation for taking on the tough stuff. And they went to court to order that there be no requirements, no race-based requirements may be made for air services in the country. Now, you can be dealing with air services that are small, large, one-man, two-man, you know, thousands of employees. So what they essentially happened is the court said that it was the Pretoria High Court ruled that such criteria are unlawful, it increased commercial freedom and access to air services in South Africa. And obviously the key thing about this court case is that it sets the groundwork for other challenges, not just those coming out of sort of think tanks and influential business, but actually from the court. So it'll be very interesting to see where this takes us. I think it's an inevitable slide away. It goes with the ANC's disintegration, but we've got some way to go. But it is a very firm and clear stance.
Hi FM, your station of choice since 2008.
This morning, I am my own guest. I'm going to discuss the overseas travails and travels of General Rudzani Mapwanya, who is the head of the chief of the South African National Defence Forces, and his by now notorious trip to Iran to meet with the heads of the defence of the army and the defence forces there. Now, he met with the new chief of staff of the Iranian Armed Forces, Major General Abdulrahim Mousavi. And his predecessor was killed in the Israeli airstrikes of a couple of months ago. And that position is directly answerable only to the supreme leader, the Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. But also present was Major General Amir Hatami, who has been appointed chief commander of the army, which was the position previously held by Mousavi. Now, Hatami acknowledged that the two countries were bound by anti-colonial, anti-arrogance, and justice-driven principles, and he advised South Africa that it had a prioritized position in Iran's foreign policy approach. Now, apparently they discussed enhancing joint military cooperation and common goals and the political alignment between the two countries, which had lent South Africa a special position in Iran's strategic outreach to Africa. And Khatami expressed the hope that this would result in concrete joint military projects. This all came out in state media, and Mapwanya then compounded an already, let's call it, ill-advised venture by saying that he conveyed the greetings of South Africa's president and defense minister, affirming that the Republic of South Africa and the Islamic Republic of Iran have common goals. Well, certainly. And he then went on to say, we, the South African people, stand alongside the oppressed and defenseless people of the world. And he went on to say that there was long-standing mutual respect between Tehran and Pretoria and called for deeper defense ties. Now, this whole bizarre sort of statement from the one side and from the other side, all agreeing in the same backslapping manner, is, to my mind, just such an inversion of truth. It's for me, it's that is what is most vile about this whole trip. Now, there have been calls for, there was immediately outrage because essentially, outrage occurred obviously because at this very moment, South Africa keeps trying to go back to the US with a proposal on trade that will help to reset relationships between the US and South Africa and do something about the 30% or more tariff that the US has imposed on South African goods, particularly agriculture and mineral resources. Now, a lot of the commentary has been along the lines of the fact that, you know, it was an extremely, extremely ill-advised thing to do at this point in time, particularly given the relationship with America, or rather the lack of a relationship with America. Our attempts so far, including President Ramaphosa's ill-fated trip to Washington of a couple of months ago now, have yielded nothing. And all that has happened since Ramaphosa returned to South Africa is that he's doubled down on all of the things that the Americans showed displeasure in. Expropriation without compensation, the BEE laws, the whole issue of farm murders. But probably the core issue that really angers America the most is South Africa's relationship with Iran. It is not so much, I mean, it's certainly a part of it, and it's the way it conducts its relationship, but it's not so much its support for Russia and China. There are other countries that have relations with Russia, China, and the US, and they somehow manage that discrepancy, shall I call it. That, per se, is not what would make or break South Africa's relationship with America. It is the relationship with Iran. Now, bear in mind that obviously Iran is the world's leading sponsor of terror. It's not just the fact that it has all the proxies that we are horribly aware of in the war since the 7th of October. And one doesn't have to go into that. But the very fact that the Iranian government, through its proxies, through its revolutionary guards, is actually fomenting and committing assassinations in Europe and other parts of the world in order to either get at its enemies or to expand its influence as a jihadi, to promote its jihadi philosophy of taking over, you know, essentially reinvigorating a caliphate and making Shia Islam as touted as, you know, sort of the perfect version of Islamic grace, increasing its influence. And its influence is, this really goes to show that the intention of getting a foothold in Southern Africa, which if it hasn't already got a significant foothold, South Africa provides the ideal opportunity. I would say, while the commentators have generally said, you know, it is outrageous, he should be court-martialed, the DA has asked for the general to be court-martialed, the Minister of Defence and Veteran Affairs, Angie Motshekga, should be fired by Cyril Ramaphosa. The only problem is that, you know, while the Department of International Relations and Cooperation and the Department of Defence came out very quickly and said, you know, to clarify that the implementation of South Africa's foreign policy is the function of the presidency supported by DERCO. It is not for the general to represent the government's official foreign policy stance. They both said the same thing, and theoretically, the comment from the defense ministry should have reflected Motshekga, and that, you know, she was going to apparently do something when he returned. She's since denied it and clarified that she made it completely clear that she approved of the trip last year. It had been postponed once and it had gone ahead now. She defended him absolutely. She said there was nothing wrong with what he said, that the president, who has denied knowing that the general was visiting did not sanction the visit. He didn't have to. It was in the arms of the Ministry of Defence. So she's essentially saying, you know, nothing to see here. Let's just move on. And it appears that she regards the trip and the precarious position we're in with the Americans right now is purely coincidental. The tensions between them, Iran and the U.S. and us negotiating tariffs, all of this tension is a coincidence. The inside track from within government, an unnamed source in the Sunday Times, indicated that it is unlikely that the president was going to either fire Angie Motshekga or demand the general's removal in whichever way one removes generals, whether it's a court-martial or in other ways. And I think that is really what we've come to expect in this matter, because essentially, if you look at all the denials and the reaffirming that where the right to express foreign policy comes from, they're not denying that the trip was organized. They're not denying that, at the very least, the Ministry of Defense authorized it. They're essentially just saying, the timing wasn't great. He shouldn't have gone now, and he shouldn't have said what he said. And of course, what it says to me is that there are two things. One is the South Africans are not near the equal of Iran in terms of deflection, inverting the truth, and pinning down even their friends in public media statements that make them appear to have commitments to Iran that maybe he didn't mean to communicate. He's not a diplomat. It probably wouldn't have occurred to him. And I have very little doubt that the message he would have got was, he's not proclaiming government policy on international affairs. He's really reiterating it. He's not, this is, as someone described it, business as usual. It's not as if he's suddenly gone across to Iran and got friendly and wants to cooperate on a military basis. This is ANC policy. It's not government policy, because the ANC has made sure that the government of national unity, the other parties, are kept a million miles away from foreign affairs matters and international policy. So I'm not sure about it. I know that there are views that there's something much more sinister in that having someone who's in charge of the military, who is actually subject to the civilian oversight of the president in the ministry and parliament, going across with these sort of agreements to further military cooperation, etc., is actually a sign of a possible coup in the making, that somehow this is intended to embarrass Cyril Ramaphosa and weaken his position from those in his caucus in the NEC who are opposed to him, who would have preferred the DA not to be in the GNU and rather to have MK and or the EFF there, like-minded far left autocratic entities, and that it's really that solid block in the ANC that is really seeking to embarrass Cyril Ramaphosa so that they can possibly get him out of his position even in advance of the elective conference, the ANC elective conference in 2027. I think there are very many facets of this that would certainly accord to that view of a military man going rogue when he has no constitutional right, no rights have been delegated to him to do it. But as I say, I come back to the point that he's really publicly embracing something that's already that already exists. And I don't think he could do. I don't think he could do the relationship with the U.S. any great damage. I think the U.S. has such a poor view of our relationship with Iran and the fact that it led, that South Africa led the charge, seemingly at the behest of the Iran, to the ICJ in taking Israel there, accusing them of genocide. Perhaps I'm being a bit too sanguine about their approach. I don't know, but it's quite interesting the extent to which they've been calls from all sorts of quarters, politically left, right, and centre, literally, for action to be taken, for him to go, for Motshekga to go, etc. But it's not likely to happen. One could argue perhaps that Motshekga is part of that very dominant force in the NEC that saw this as an opportunity to embarrass the president and to put pressure on him and give an excuse to the NEC to do something. But maybe one's attributing too much malice where pure incompetence or not paying attention will definitely answer the question at the time. You know, the source that the Sunday Times quotes says fundamentally the general did not do anything wrong. But you can also ask, was it necessary for him to partake in the kinds of statements that were attributed to him? And the answer is no, it was not necessary. But that suggests that it wasn't necessary, but it wasn't something that the government in the form of the presidency or the Ministry of Defense would have given much thought to, as if anything was said and sanctioned or not, that it would do South Africa any harm, it was doing anything. It wasn't already part of its own policy. But for South Africa, the entire relationship with Iran just goes from bad to worse. We cannot possibly benefit from having such a close relationship with such a distinctly malign actor as Iran. And of course one has to bear in mind, and I think one tends to forget it because it's somewhat historical, that Hezbollah was responsible, with the backing at the behest of Iran, for the death of over 300 people in the Beirut Marine Barracks bombings and the embassy bombings in 1983. That really presaged the large-scale terrorist action against the West. And what South Africa seems to not have understood, and I don't know if they give any thought to it, is that attack on American interests is seen as an attack on America, in much the same way that the Americans, the court cases are being launched in America against Iran and against its proxies for dual citizens who were killed as a result of October the 7th, or taken hostage as a result of October the 7th. If you essentially harm or threaten to harm or kill an American citizen, doesn't matter whether they share citizenship with another country or not, you are attacking American interests. And America is the most powerful country in the world, despite all its trials, tribulations, and the overall effect of going from a Democratic administration to a Republican administration. That, for someone as single-minded as Trump, as insofar as he can be single-minded, but when he is, that will have disastrous consequences on anyone who is seen to be supporting the foes of America. And there's probably a certain amount of business can be done with China and Russia, but Iran holds a special spot as being essentially a murderous regime. And of course, civil rights just don't pertain in Iran at all. So for us to say that, you know, we support human rights and the press peoples, I mean, honestly. So perhaps, as I say, perhaps I'm being sanguine, but maybe we shouldn't be attributing to malice what we could be attributing to incompetence and laziness.
High FM, 101.9 megahertz of life.
Well, I don't know if anyone else had the innovating experience of watching some of the national dialogue that kicked off on Friday. I think it went on Friday and Saturday. Despite every civil society foundation that has been involved in the dialogue, including the Thabo Mbeki Foundation, his foundation, and he was essentially the progenitor of the whole idea originally, and Cyril Ramaphosa seized on it. I think in the absence of being able to do anything that's to the benefit of us, he wanted to appear to give us the opportunity to talk. But the ANC essentially took the whole thing over. Every aspect of this dialogue is being run by the ANC. The problem I have with the dialogue is that you know, a dialogue is something that it just is dealt with very subtly, not subtly, but quietly. It takes time. You got to approach different interests. But the problem is you can never be sure that you're getting, you can't possibly get all the interests in South African society into a national dialogue where you have what for me it was, I thought, a rather embarrassing kickoff to the event in a conference hall in UNISA. Because if you immediately, despite the flowery words of the conveners and the eminent persons who were there, again picked by the ANC, who are mostly people who either retired or don't hold prominent positions in public life anymore. The DA is not there. They went from the word go. AfriForum, Solidarity, I think Action SA eventually called it quits. It's a 1T show. And they literally got kicked because you got people standing up, whether they're young women representing a group or Rastafarians representing apparently the 3 million Rastafarians in this country. I don't know if that's an exaggeration. Criticizing the government from a dizzy height about what it had not done or the extent to which it had diminished the quality of lives of South African citizens. So it's really I think it's been hijacked by the government. The ANC. It's been hijacked by the ANC. It's meant to be a long, very expensive, extended process that was probably trying to create an impression that in the next year and a bit leading up to the local elections and the elective conference after that, that somehow the ANC has been pulling back. Well, by the time it's heard what anyone who's even talking to them has to say about what it was they want and need, all one can say is that we told them no one has to be asked what they want or need. We all know what the country needs. We all know, what is good for the country as a whole is good for a whole range of interest groups who may have very different needs, but the core need is economic growth to encourage the creation of business and reduce our what is probably the highest unemployment rate in the world. I think it's at just over 33% and over 60% for youth unemployment. I mean, you have literally rendered, you've watched a cohort of society that grew up under apartheid, saw the ANC as agents of change, and now their children are very, very much more less likely to ever hold a job than they are. And they are in a situation where even they are saying, we've supported the ANC all this way until this point. We can't do it any longer. There really is a backlash. And people are starting to say from the most surprising quarters, the ANC has to go. And to hold a dialogue is really, all you're doing is literally laying down and waiting to be kicked, because the only people who are saying nice things are those who've organized it. Everybody else is attacking them. And while Cyril Ramaphosa is pretending that, you know, this is good, this is what, you know, people must speak out and come to the fore, I think he's probably already regretting his commitment to this thing. And the fact that it wasn't his idea to start with, but he's grabbed ownership of it and he's committed to it, and hundreds of millions of our taxpayers' money is going to go into it to no benefit whatsoever. This is a way of the government appearing to be listening and caring when it knows well what it needs to do, and it needs to do the one thing that liberation movements just generally aren't good at doing, and that is changing tack when all else has failed again and again and again. So I think this national if Cyril Ramaphosa is lucky, this national dialogue will die a death, and he must leave it to the civic society in the sense that it's needed at all. That's another thing altogether. So you will be unsurprised to learn that that Eskom has spent 5.8 billion rand on diesel this year, but the Minister of Energy, Minister Ramaphosa, Kgosietso Ramaphosa, has said, but the situation is improving. Now, I'm not quite sure what he means by the situation improving. He says that Eskom, the utility, had experienced challenges at the beginning of the financial year in April, and they'd relied more on diesel to support it during peak times and times of difficulty. And then with the intensity of demand that always comes with winter, it was really a challenge, and we don't have, as he says, headroom to absorb failures of units. Now, let's put it this way. To still be relying to this extent on diesel does not suggest that things are getting better or not getting better enough, and particularly given the fact that there isn't really anywhere near as great a demand for electricity as there was prior to the peak years of load shedding, because the private sector, both businesses and suburban and home, in many areas have gone off the grid. So they've taken a distinct chunk of demand. And of course, with a disaster of almost no growth in the economy, there are businesses, and in some cases very big businesses, like we discussed last week, ArcelorMittal, that are going out of business. And they are huge consumers of electricity. And the other big consumers of water, and to some extent electricity, is the agricultural sector. And that, of course, threatens to be hit not so much by the demise or otherwise, or whether the AGOA continues to give preferential rates to our farmers, but the very fact that the tariffs that Donald Trump has imposed on us are going to see businesses go out of business at an enormous rate and affecting thousands and tens of thousands of people. So I'm not sure if there's ever going to be the demand for Eskom as it's currently structured to ever get back up, to have the demand to actually necessitate getting their ducks in a row with regard to the provision of electricity. Isn't that a contradictory set of thoughts?
Hi FM, your station of choice since 2008.
Now, the DA, who does regular polling monthly and fairly reliably, has been doing it for years, and to the voting patterns and the attitudes of South Africans at any given moment monthly, reveals that the ANC, the polling suggests that if South Africans voted sort of now, the ANC would get no more than 20% of the vote in Johannesburg. And the DA looks like it could get in the region of 38%. And it's usually, the DA has been fairly circumspect where its fortunes have not looked that that good. But and this is probably also ties in to the fact that the very idea that Helen Zille could be the mayor of Johannesburg actually ups the DA's chances. I think the sense of looking for someone who's tough and uncompromising and not corrupt is just overwhelming. But, you know, we'll see where the polls go once she, if she becomes a candidate and actually hits the road. I'm not sure she would be able to do it for more than a few years, and who she mentors would become very important. But this also ties in with another set of surveys that have been done by the Mapungubwe Institute for Strategic Reflection. And they've suggested from their polling that the Free State and Mpumalanga are two provinces under pressure of not being ANC majority provinces after the next provincial and national elections, and that the only provinces that are probably safe as ANC majority run provinces are Limpopo and the Eastern Cape. So if you think about it, I mean, whatever the fortunes of, say, the DA in the Western Cape may be, with sudden increased pressure from the PA and possibly other forces, they're essentially, what they're hinting at is that 7 out of 9 provinces are likely to be run by coalitions. 7 out of 9. Only 2 are likely to have ANC majority. And otherwise, I think particularly in places like Gauteng, KZN, and certainly the Western Cape, whoever else may be baying at the snapping at the DA's heels, the ANC is literally, I would hesitate to say, the ANC, that tipping point of last year's national election to 40%, it could regain, sustain that position, maybe even get better, but it would have to do some really substantial things for the people. And I think that dam has burst. The extent to which it would have to curry favour, it just is in no position to do the basics, let alone to reward people for voting for them. So it's worth watching the surveys as they come out. They don't predict exactly what's going to happen. They're a snapshot of where we are in a moment in time, but they give a sense of the zeitgeist of where people are at in various parts of South Africa at the moment. And the ANC is really dragging behind, and I think running out of time, space, and speed. So with that as a sort of potential good news, because I think it's the only way we're going to get things right in this country is if we diminish the ANC's power. No guarantees anyway, but it's certainly a positive. Thank you very much for being with me this week, and hopefully you'll join me again next week, and we'll look into some more politics that affects everything that we do with me, Sara Gon, from Sara Gon Rogue.